Pampers Cruisers 360 is the must-have diaper to help keep your baby from taking it right off, which, if you've experienced this, can lead to complete chaos. With its 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your baby for a comfortable fit, your active baby can move freely. Think of it as baby yoga pants. Cruisers 360 offers a gap-free fit and has a blowout barrier at the back of the diaper to help stop any unwanted disasters. The best part? That stretchy waistband makes it so easy to change your wiggly baby, who is always on the move and can't be stopped. Just rip the sides to remove and roll it up with the disposal tape on the back. Voila! Pampers Cruisers are available in sizes 3 to 7 and now feature fun new prints. Pair with new Pampers Free and Gentle Wipes, made from 100% plant-based cloth that grips the mess without fear of tearing. With Free and Gentle, mess meets its match. For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician-recommended brand.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Laura Vanderkam. I'm a mother of five, an author, journalist, and speaker.
And I'm Sarah Hart Unger, a mother of three, practicing physician, writer, and course creator. We are two working parents who love our careers and our families.
Welcome to Best of Both Worlds. Here we talk about how real women manage work, family, and time for fun. From figuring out childcare to mapping out long-term career goals, we want you to get the most out of life.
Welcome to Best of Both Worlds. This is Laura. This episode is airing in mid-April of 2024. We are just around tax day in the United States. So appropriately, we are having a financial-themed episode. I'm going to be interviewing Bobby Rebell, who is the author of Launching Financial Grownups. She also has a company that is organized around the same concept of how you can help young adults begin their financial lives, preparing for the grown-up world of money and all the things they will need to know for that. So especially for our listeners who have tweens and teens, some topics that definitely might be worth thinking about as you ponder how to help your kids build their own independent lives. So speaking of being a financial grown-up, Sarah, at what point were you actually a financial grown-up? If we are at this point, I guess we are. We both have mortgages. That's like right there. Yes, you are a grown-up if you have a mortgage. Yes.
But I definitely feel like I was a much later bloomer to financial adulthood than you, as you're going to share your story. In college, I would classify myself as fairly irresponsible. Before that, also fairly irresponsible if I had any money lying around. And I always enjoyed earning some money, but I also enjoyed spending some money. So it didn't stick around for very long. And then I did take a trip to Europe in which I put everything on my credit card and had to be bailed out by my parents. Okay, like full disclosure, it was a very inexpensive trip. Like we were staying in hostels. I don't think the grand total was anything all that crazy, but my parents did kindly bail me out, but told me they would never, ever, ever do that again. So that I better grow up from here on out. And you know what? I did. I really did. Because then I was an MD PhD and I lived on a like $18,000 a year salary. And I was like, okay, this is all I have. And I can't go in the negative because I have to pay my rent every month. And I actually ended up moving in with Josh after we started dating, but I paid a portion of the mortgage for the house that he had. So like, I think I became a grown-up at that point. I was not good about saving, but at least I understood how much can you save when you're earning $18,000 a year? Maybe Laura could, but I couldn't. But at least I was good about not allowing myself to go into the red and understanding what a budget was. And then I feel like my first couple years of earning a real salary, I was just sort of like, I don't know, figuring things out. It seemed to me from the outset like the money was going to be infinite and became very quickly clear that it wasn't. And so in 2015, we discovered you need a budget and became really systematic about saving. And I feel like that is actually when I became a financial grown-up.
Wow.
At age 35.
Yeah, 2015. Not that long ago. So wait, I got to pause. So Josh owned a house in med school?
It was a very inexpensive house. He had worked prior to that. So
He started it older. That's right. Okay.
Yeah. And I think there was some help there as well. That house was bought for something like $130,000 and then sold for like $130,000. So it was not like, it was not a fancy house.
Was he renting out other rooms of it? Was it like that kind of thing or?
No.
Okay.
I mean, how much can you split up a house that's that size? And the neighborhood quickly didn't do so well, hence us selling it. Actually, we may have sold it for under what we bought it for, which is kind of what we do in our family.
Yeah, your real estate history. Fortunately, there are booms and busts, and the Unger household seems to their moves. Unfortunately, you can't always time these things to being convenient for the real estate market. I'm sort of thinking back, like I went away for high school for my last 2 years, and so I had to have some way of paying for things. I actually had my own checkbook. Like I remember checkbooks for like, it was, which I remember then because I wanted to get my college decision letters at my mailing address at school. And so I had written the checks for the application fees. I think my parents had put money in the account for that. But it's kind of funny to think, I wonder how many kids are signing their own checks to pay for their application fees for college. It's probably not that many. But yeah, my first, I worked in the summers and in college. I got my first apartment for a summer. We could do a temporary rental thing. I shared with a couple of people in Washington, D.C. So I had an apartment, 19. I learned to cook. That was kind of fun. And then my first job after college, I had this year-long internship at USA Today where my stipend for the year was something like $18,000. And, you know, my take-home pay was like $1,200 a month. And I remember my rent was $580. So, you know, you had $620 to play around with each month and it was mostly fine. I didn't have a car. I was taking public transit and shopped sales at the grocery store and cooked most of my own meals and also created margin by freelancing. The more I think about it, if I had really truly tried to live on just that, it would have been a lot tighter. But then I was like, well, I can write for places. People are willing to pay me. And the good news about having a take-home pay of $1,200 a month is that even if you're getting like $300 for something, it feels like a pretty big raise. So that was, I was able to save most of that, which helped, you know, finance the move to New York City after that. But I remember reading like the newspaper when I was 12 or 13 years old, waiting for the bus and looking at the stocks and being interested in the stock market at the time. And now it would have been great if I'd actually invested then. But of course, that's not something my parents knew much about at all. And the upside is that we are now having our kids do that. They get a brokerage account when they are 10. We do a match of money that they have saved up. It's a fairly sizable match, multiple of what they have saved up so that we can meet the brokerage minimum. Then they choose what they're going to invest in. And I'm not sure if everyone's learning the right lessons from this. Like one child didn't want to invest in anything because there was a possibility of losing money, which I don't think is the right lesson to learn. Another child was kind of getting into the day trading idea, be like, look, I made $50 today without doing anything. I'm like, oh no, that's maybe not the right lesson either. But you know, you're young, you don't have to buy index funds. I don't know. It's probably good they're learning it now. Whatever. They can be financial grownups even earlier. Turns out that Disney was not a great stock to own. Even if you love Disney, it was for a long period of time really crappy stock to own.
I kind of feel like if you let that experiment go on long enough, if there was one of the five kids that chose index funds, they're probably going to win. And then they will all learn a good lesson.
Yeah, the one child is, you know, still in the whatever the brokerage random interest rate is because they refused. People's personalities come out very young. All right, well, let's hear what Bobby has to say about launching Financial Grownups.
So Sarah and I are delighted to welcome Bobbi Rebell to the program. She is a journalist turned author turned financial wellness consultant, is the author of the book Launching Financial Grownups, which I know is relevant to a lot of people with kids in the teen emerging adult years. So welcome, Bobbi.
Thank you so much for having me. I am a listener and a big fan of the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, why don't you introduce a little bit more about yourself to our listeners?
Well, first of all, again, thank you for having me and thank you for that introduction. I am a mom of three in a blended family. I have now a 27-year-old, a 24-year-old, and a 16-year-old. The 27-year-old is a sort of already launched, and the 24-year-old is in the middle of launching, I would say. He's out of college, had his first job, and now figuring out a pivot. And then the teenager is on the crux of getting ready to start thinking about college. He took his first practice ACT recently. So I'm sort of mixed feelings because in a way, I'm sort of happy to be in the home stretch of it. But also, it's hitting me hard as a parent that, wow, this phase of my life is really about to start changing. And I'm sort of bracing for that. And career-wise, I'm going through some changes as well, expanding my business beyond being an author into more financial wellness consulting. I have a company called Financial Wellness Strategies. We do workshops for companies, for schools, for parent groups, and I'm now expanding into doing some limited private consulting.
Awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit about your journey of launching at least two financial grownups at this point, a third, we hope, in a couple of years. Was it a smooth flying path? Was it bumpy? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
It was so bumpy, Laura. It was really tragic because, as we mentioned, I had been a journalist for many years and I was in the business beat. So I interviewed CEOs and talked about money. I even, at one point, had a globally syndicated column on personal finance topics. And yet, my almost adult children, and I'm referencing the older ones at this point, were one was just starting college, one was in high school, and they were not really receptive to my mini lessons about money. And I found it very frustrating. And one thing that I write about in the book, Launching Financial Grownups, is my efforts, for example, to get them to open up Roth IRAs. So I had kids that were good kids. They both were earning money because they like to earn money, which is great. Ashley was always learning to be higher and higher level as a lifeguard. She was very good at teaching. And so she was keenly aware that if she got different certifications, she could make more money. And number two, Bradley was very enterprising, teaching kids fencing. He eventually went to school, basically recruited for fencing. He's very good at that. So these were good, ambitious kids doing their thing. And yet I couldn't get them to open up a Roth IRA. Why? I was like, you guys have all this money. They weren't big spenders. And they would always yes me. And I kind of had to figure out, okay, what is going on? And so that inspired the book because you had an educated parent. You had kids that were sort of on a good path. These weren't problem kids. And so I figured, well, I know one thing I have access to as a journalist is experts, right? I could tune in and ask people. I had financial therapy friends. I had parenting expert friends. And I, of course, had money expert friends. And so the book really taps into that. I figured I had a problem. Maybe other people did too. And I think that was proven pretty true because the book has really resonated with a lot of parents and I should say grandparents.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what was it? Let's talk about the Roth IRA because I mean, was it just that it's annoying to call customer service somewhere? It's annoying to find documents? I mean, what would you say it was?
Yeah. So for the older one, she was just yesing me. And like, I would always, first of all, approach them at absolutely the wrong time. I learned, you know, they're walking out the door. It's with anything you want a kid to do, especially a teenager. If you're interrupting something that they are just, they're going to say what they want to say. So they would say, I'm on it. They wouldn't say I'm doing it. They would say, I heard you. I know. I understand, but they wouldn't say I'm doing it. And I would give them, as you said, I would give them the name of somebody at the brokerage firm that I used. I said, you can talk to a human. You can go online. You can open up with a different company. I don't care what you do. What do you need to get this done? And the oldest one looked at me and she said, but you didn't ask me about my goals and what I want to do with the money. Well, what she wanted to do with the money, Laura, was she wanted to save it to buy an apartment, a down payment. And if she put it in an investment account, then she'd be risking it. And since, you know, you're supposed to have a 5-year time horizon, that was not the right thing for her to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So she didn't want to have a conflict with me. But in fact, I was giving her the wrong advice because I hadn't asked her goal.
Yeah. Now that's interesting. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I wasn't listening to her. Actually, I wasn't listening because I wasn't even asking her.
Yeah.
Whether it made sense for her. And then number two was more of a classic thing. He was just a teen who just wasn't getting around to it. And I needed to actually sit with him. And what I've done with him that's worked so well, and I'm so proud of him, is generally when there's something to do, I kind of sit side by side. And this is something Julie Lithcott-Haynes, who wrote How to Raise an Adult, advocates. So I got this from her. I just want to give her credit. You sit with them at the computer. And the first time you sort of show them what to do, the second time you watch them do it. You know what I mean? It's a gradual progression. And I really had to sit down with him and set it up. And I'll tell you, right now, he has a very nice amount of money in that Roth IRA, and to the point where he was able to fully fund it and then also open a non-retirement brokerage account. And so because he didn't have the goal to buy an apartment, he has done very well over the years with his investing. And we have conversations about investing. He was very critical, and I don't know when this is going to come out, but right now NVIDIA is in the news, and he wanted to know why I hadn't bought NVIDIA. And we had a whole conversation, and he told me about his friends that were day trading and how much his friends made on NVIDIA. Dear. But the point is, we're having the conversations. Yeah. It doesn't actually matter what I did or didn't do in investing. The point is, he's asking questions, we're having conversations, and he's learning to make his own decisions. He did go and buy NVIDIA. I personally thought it was overvalued. Today, as of this recording, he's up.
Yep.
So could there
be
you
down.
Go.
Could be down in another week or two. Whoever knows. Yes, it's been.
But the
up
money
a
is
lot.
His, and yeah. the money is yeah. real.
It's really
and
it's real.
And he's investing it. And it. I don't want to say it doesn't matter what he does. I mean, if he comes to me and says an investment that I don't think is good, I'll tell him why I don't think it's good. But I also tell him I could be wrong. I also don't own any Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And right now, I don't look so smart, but I don't know. But you have to let your kids make those mistakes when it comes to investing, the important thing. And they have so much time, Laura.
Yeah.
I mean, so, I don't want to say some
retirement,
mistakes.
Yeah, many, like, many years for things to recover.
Even he says his friends are day trading. You can say to a kid, well, I don't think that's the way to go. But if you think that's something interesting, why don't you take 10% of your savings and you can day trade with that?
Yeah.
If that's what they want. Because what you really don't want to do, especially with teenagers, is create an environment where they feel you will judge them, and therefore they will hide a mistake. So an example of that would be maybe they ran up credit card debt and they don't tell you because they know you'd be disappointed. They know they should know better. You don't want them to run up the credit card debt, but the only thing worse than that is to hide it from you and not be able to have that conversation.
So what does it mean to be a financial grown-up? I mean, I was pondering this. I wonder if I am a financial grown-up at this point. You know, I'm many years along from the teenage years, but what would you define as being a financial grown-up?
I think it's important that everyone have their own definition to some degree, but essentially it's taking responsibility and ownership of your financial life, what that means. So with kids, I like to tell them, kids, I'm talking about teenagers in early 20s, I want to see the numbers. What does it cost to be you? What does it cost? I asked the middle child this recently, what would it cost you if you were to do X, Y, and Z? Because he's figuring out career plans. Can your career plan support what you want? The lifestyle that you want. And you have to find a balance, right? If you want to live a very modest lifestyle, you can choose a career that supports that. And so it's really important for them to understand the math of their own life. And then we have to take a step back because sometimes we impose on them our own values and our own priorities when it comes to the lifestyle that we want to live. And we over-subsidize them. In other words, they'll say, I want to do this and I'm willing to live this way. And I'm willing to have three roommates because I want to go do this career that's very risky and I won't have enough money. We have to be careful not to interfere with that. We have to let it play out. And it is really hard. It's something that I struggle with to this day because we want to make their life easier, especially if we struggled, we relate to that. And it's sometimes harder the more resources you have to teach a kid to be a financial grown-up. It's hard.
Well, do you think it's in general harder than in the past? I mean, I know there's been a lot of headlines about between levels of student loans or the price of housing in certain markets. Although obviously it sounds like your daughter did in fact manage to purchase a home. So she's, you know, the millennial Gen Z, whatever it is that has managed to become a property owner. But do you think, I mean, is it harder or is it not? I mean, what would you say?
I do think that there are some systemic societal changes that have happened, but I also think the lens that we see things through has changed. And I think it's very interesting to observe as a society that very often we will frame it, for example, as a negative when someone moves home after college or stays home after high school if they're not going to college. And I view it in most cases as a positive because I think it's unrealistic to say to someone, okay, you just graduated college, possibly with debt too. You're getting your first job, hopefully your lowest paying job ever. You may or may not have health insurance and other benefits because the gig economy has grown so much and because we now have the Affordable Care Act. And so a lot of companies can sort of get away with not giving health insurance until kids are 26. So is it even realistic to set a kid up for failure to go out and suddenly be their own household? Like, why is that considered the norm? Why isn't the norm, hey, if it's available to you, go home, regroup, create a financial foundation as our oldest did, right? She stayed home for 2 years. I discussed this in the book in more detail. But basically, in launching Financial Grownups, I explain how she moved home with a very specific plan. She wasn't a slacker, like we used to call Gen Xers when we moved home. She was very much proactively saving to have not only the money for a down payment, to have the money for the closing costs, to make sure her credit score was high enough that she could get a good mortgage, and to make sure she had the emergency backup fund so she wouldn't have to ask us for money, knowing that we would be there if she did need it. Yeah. I think it's really important for parents to not say, we're not there for you. Let the kid know we're there for you, but we expect you won't need it. We hope you won't need it, but of course we're going to be there for you. I think that should be the norm. Let kids come home, because how else are they going to build an emergency fund? If they're living paycheck to paycheck and they're struggling to pay down student debt, which we know mathematically is higher than it was in past generations, it's not realistic for us to just kind of throw them out there to the wolves. And I also think, and we learned this in COVID, that there's a very special relationship when adult kids can live at home for a defined period of time with a plan, with an exit strategy. I'm not saying indefinitely because they do have to grow up, but it's kind of nice to have that relationship evolve and for them to see you. With the launch of this book, I finally learned some of the ups and downs that my parents had had financially that I had no idea. And it took until now for it to come out, prompted by the book. But my parents, I think, to some degree, overshielded me because I never understood that maybe it wasn't so easy to write that check for something going on. I was oblivious as a child. Let them in the amount you feel comfortable. I'm not saying open it all up if it's not appropriate, but sometimes sharing with them that you're just not a bottomless pit of money to support whatever activity they want can be really valuable. And also just empathetic. If they understand that you didn't always have it so easy, and you struggled, and maybe you had career insecurities or whatever it may be, that really opens up a new chapter in your relationship that can be so wonderful.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick ad break. We'll be back with more from Bobby Rebel about launching Financial Grownups.
Pampers Cruisers 360 is the must-have diaper to help keep your baby from taking it right off, which, if you've experienced this, can lead to complete chaos. With its 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your baby for a comfortable fit, your active baby can move freely. Think of it as baby yoga pants. Cruisers 360 offers a gap-free fit and has a blowout barrier at the back of the diaper to help stop any unwanted disasters. The best part? That stretchy waistband makes it so easy to change your wiggly baby, who is always on the move and can't be stopped. Just rip the sides to remove and roll it up with the disposal tape on the back. Voila! Pampers Cruisers are available in sizes 3 to 7 and now feature fun new prints. Pair with new Pampers Free and Gentle Wipes, made from 100% plant-based cloth that grips the mess without fear of tearing. With Free and Gentle, mess meets its match. For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand.
Today's episode is sponsored in part by Thrive Cosmetics. I am a speed demon when it comes to my makeup routine. I have approximately 5 minutes, or maybe 3, between showering and starting my routine of getting the kids out the door for school. And so I'm always looking for products to keep things super streamlined and easy for my everyday look. Thrive Cosmetics for years has been part of that. I've discussed the Brilliant Eye Brightener before, which is a serious workhorse for making me look more awake. But lately, I'm also super into their Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara. It's a tubing mascara that lengthens lashes and is super easy to remove as well, which is key because my makeup removal routine is just as streamlined. You can feel great about shopping at Thrive because for every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates products and funds to help communities thrive. So refresh your everyday look with Thrive Cosmetics, luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 10% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/bestof. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/bestof, BESTOF, for 10% off your first order.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we are back talking with Bobby Rebel about how we can launch financial grown-ups. And she's been talking about how moving back home is not necessarily a sign of failure, that it can be a way to build wealth in the early years when your earnings might be low, and then you have that possibility. But let's back up a few more years. Let's talk teen years, okay? So we have a lot of listeners who have kids in the tween and teen ages, and they're saying, well, I'd like to have good financial conversations with my kids. What are some ways we can open up that topic and some good ideas for how to teach kids a little bit more about how they might handle money before they're actually going out on their own?
Oh my gosh, I love this question. And the answer to your question is to ask questions. Ask them what matters to them and ask them how they feel about certain things, right? And look for openings in whatever is going on in your daily life. So you might just put them in charge, for example, of the groceries one week. Even if you're paying for it, ask them to figure out how to make a budget work, or think about ways to get them to, I guess, to kind of extract what their goals are and what they're doing to get to those goals. So, for example, thinking about the kind of lifestyle that they want to lead. What's important to them? Do they want to live in a city? Well, what career choices would make sense for that? Or what are you interested in? Hey, what does that pay? Because now we have so much salary information available online, they can go through, well, what does it cost to be me? And what does it cost? Does the math work if I want this career? And so, for example, I'm giving a lot of my own examples here. With our oldest, she had wanted to be a teacher. She was constantly getting higher and higher certifications with her lifeguards. She was amazing with kids, a great camp counselor. But she did the math. What does it cost to be me in New York City, where she wanted to live and to be comfortable and be able to go out with her friends? And she ended up switching majors in college because she wanted more income. And I think that's fine. She found something that she also loved. And it's cyber. She's a cybersecurity consultant now and pays better than teaching. And it's also fulfilling. And that doesn't mean that someday she won't teach. It doesn't mean maybe she won't teach a course on cybersecurity at a local college, right? So you can do that. But sometimes what you love doesn't have to be what you do for money. And I think that's an important lesson for teenagers. It's also important for parents to realize the way that they're communicating with their children and the subtle messages that they send can really have an impact. There's a theory called your money scripts. Have you heard of this?
I've heard that we certainly have stories about money in our heads from our backgrounds.
So the term money scripts actually comes from a financial therapist who's also a CFP named Brad Klontz. And people can Google that and learn more about it. But he basically talks about the fact that we have unconscious beliefs about money that stem from our childhood. So I say this because I want parents to be very mindful that it's not only what you directly communicate to children and teens, it's what they're observing and basically your household culture when it comes to money and the unwritten and unsaid things that you say. So maybe you get a bill and you are discussing it with your partner and they overhear it, or they hear the stress in your voice, or they hear the excitement in your voice when something good happens in your career or something like that. Just be aware that they're understanding more than you might realize, and that the unconscious messages that you're sending to them that are shaping the way that they view money. And I think that's really important for parents also, especially with teenagers.
Yeah. And I mean, with that though, I think a question probably at least some number of our listeners may have is maybe they didn't grow up with as much resources as they now have. So whatever script they absorbed from their growing up, I mean, there just wasn't as much money around, which means that there are harder choices to make all the time. Or if their parents said, we can't afford something, they actually believed it. So when they are growing up, though, with more resources, which children can pick up on, you know, they can Google your address and see what you paid for your house, right? I mean, there's just the level of transparency is there in a way that I think was not necessarily in the past. How can you sort of direct those scripts to recognizing that you still do have to make smart choices?
I love this question, and it comes up all the time. It's probably one of the most common questions that I get. There was a trend recently on TikTok called loud budgeting, and I wish I had been so clever to come up with this term. I call it positive peer pressure, because kids see so much, whether it's on social media or just among their friends, about different things and wanting to kind of keep up. You can't just say, well, we don't have the money for that. It's very hard to say no. So it's not a question of not having the money. It's a question of making different choices. And that's really the way to frame it for kids. And I think that's actually a wonderful way to approach money. Is it's not a question of not having enough. It's a question of these are the deliberate, thoughtful choices that we make with our money. It may be simply that we're going to save it because we want to have a larger financial, you know, cushion, or we want to have more money to invest. It doesn't have to be because we don't have the money for that. It's because we're choosing not to buy that one item. And I really advocate for parents not only using that with their kids, but helping their kids use that language with their peers. Because when they're teenagers, so much of that push for financial things, for material things, is coming from their peer group. And if they can learn to manage that peer pressure by saying, I could buy it, but I'm not going to. For example, I'm investing it. I'm buying NVIDIA stuff, right?
I'm becoming a day trading millionaire. You know, I don't know.
Exactly. So like you can have your fancy purse or whatever they're buying these days, your fancy sneakers, your Golden Goose sneakers for $600 or whatever they're now going for. I'm not into that. I'm going to buy $100 sneakers, which is still a lot of money. And I'm going to take the $500 and I'm going to put it into the QQQ stock market. I'm not endorsing anything, but into a technology stock index. And let's see who's got more stuff at the end of the year, whatever it may be, right? So give them the language so that not only you're having those discussions with them, but when it comes up outside the household, they have the words to support whatever their decision may be.
Yeah. And now when your kids went off to college, what was your financial arrangement with them? I mean, apart from whatever tuition and all that might be, which is its own discussion, but like in terms of financial support, was there still, or should people think that there should be ongoing support? Or I mean, at what point does that kind of evolve?
I think that's really an individual decision, and that can be influenced by many different factors, right? In my case, honestly, it was factored very much by my husband, who felt very strongly that he wanted them to focus exclusively on their studies. And we did not have a huge emphasis on them, quote, earning their own money. That said, they were on a budget. So they did not have a bottomless pit of money. I think, as I said, that's a very personal decision. I personally, when I was growing up, my father had me have jobs in college. And I think it was really valuable. But it's important that we not make these decisions in a vacuum. If we have a partner or another parent involved, sometimes you have to make a compromise and do something that you can kind of both live with, which is a delicate way of saying I didn't get my way. I think it's really good for kids to have jobs.
Yeah.
But that hasn't always happened because, again, I'm not a household of one. It's not a dictatorship. We have to compromise. And he felt that was the best thing to do. But I will tell you, these are kids that were getting very strong grades, that were doing very important work in the community. And actually, I correct myself, during the pandemic, my stepson did actually work from home. He worked for me,
yeah.
And he worked for a company that I worked for at the time. They needed production help because I was suddenly broadcasting from home.
Yep.
and they hired him and they really did put him to work. So he did actually have a job. So I have to correct myself. He did have a job and he did invest that money. And again, it's doing very well.
Yeah.
He actually has proven to be a very strong investor. So I'm very proud of how he's putting that money to use. I think, like I said, it's a family discussion. And it's also kid specific, because what works for, you know, I have three kids. You have, I think, five.
I do.
You have five kids. And are they all the same personality?
They are not in any way the same personality at all.
Exactly. So I think it's really important that we have a lot of gray areas when it comes to kids. And people may listen to me as an expert, but you know what? You do you. Your kids are all individuals. And you guys, you know in your heart what they need. I think jobs can be great to provide structure. I think if that's first, and also, of course, if there's an economic need for them to have their own spending money, I think the best thing is to have a kid have a job and that's their spending money.
Yeah.
And if you can cover the tuition, that's great. I certainly think the jobs where you work for your tuition, in part, you may have a combination of grants. I think it's called the work study. I think those are amazing. They're great because those jobs are, they're like the best jobs. I was always jealous of the kids that had those jobs in college because they have all the fun jobs, you know? I was folding clothes at a store that was similar to The Gap, but that was my job in college, was just working retail. I think it really can vary. And the important thing is that your kid is aware of the value of the school you're sending them to. If you're paying all the tuition, you should show them the bills. And that is one thing I did, is I would show them every bill so mm-hmm. that they could see how much it costs. And also, I would have them get the bills and ask for reimbursement for activities.
Mm-hmm.
That way, they're really, when they physically see the bill and they have to ask you for that sorority dues to be paid back into their account, they're aware of the cost rather than them just magically being paid. So it's all about the conversations, and it's also about what is right for each individual kid.
And well, and with that, I understand from some things you've written and said that you are not a big fan of the idea of people like cutting off kids at an arbitrary age, that there's not like some point that everyone has to be fully on their own, that you've seen happy families do different things at different ages.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, but I will say candidly that the book Launching Financial Grownups is written in theory for parents and grandparents and adults who love them, ages 16 to 26 is the range. And there is a reason for that.
That's when the health insurance goes away, right? 26?
That's exactly it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If I'd written it before the Affordable Care Act, it probably would have been 22, 23.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But I do think that is, our society kind of has extended adolescence into the 20s at this point from a financial standpoint, where they do create this financial tie that makes sense. If it doesn't cost me more money to put the 24-year-old on our health insurance, which happens to be the case right now, why would I ever create an artificial bill to prove a point?
Yeah.
That's silly.
Yeah.
And I do talk a lot about the family ecosystem and never increasing costs to prove a point. If you have a kid on your phone bill and they cost $50 a month, but to have them on their own would be $100 a month. Keep them on your phone bill. They can pay you back on, set up an auto pay where they're hitting you with a $50 a month. They can reimburse you, but by all means, don't create artificial bills. That's just silly.
So funny story with that. I mean, I came of age before cell phones, right? So I was always had my own plan. My little brother, who is a number of years younger than me, obviously grew up with a cell phone in his high school. And so he was on my parents' plan forever, right? Like into his 30s and so on. At some point in his 30s, he's like, okay, this is enough. So he got a family plan and put my parents on it. So now
love
it's
that.
The other way.
Love that.
So they can be on his plan now forever.
Wait, but that's genius, because the point is, if it's going to be cheaper for the family ecosystem, do it, right?
Yeah.
If Netflix is allowing you 5 logins at any household, I don't know exactly, I haven't looked recently how they phrase it, but if, I don't want to advocate anyone breaking the law, but by all means, share subscriptions if there's a family plan that makes sense for you. And you don't have to nickel and dime your kids. If you're already paying and it's a unlimited, you know, it's up to 6 people in your family, well, you don't fit in there, but you know.
Some of my kid is going to be on his own for his own Netflix.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know who it is. We'll see who's the highest earner.
Right. But I told the kids, so I was paying for Spotify. I think the plan is up to 6 users. I said, you could be on my Spotify free, no problem, because it's not costing me anything more. The phone plan, if the phone costs me $50 more, you're paying me back the $50, right? So that they're aware of it. If they choose to not use Spotify and they want to use another one, you're not paying for it.
You're right? On your own with that, with the competitor.
You're on your own, but it just makes sense. But as to the, you know, the cutoff age, it's not about a one-time cutoff. It's really about creating an exit strategy. And that is something, there's a whole chapter in the book called The Exit Strategy. You don't want it to go on indefinitely. And it's not about a magical age, but let's say they do something for a few years and then they go to a graduate school. And again, something makes sense to share some expense in some way, like for them to live at home. Well, let them live at home. I got divorced very young. I'm now remarried, but I lived at home for a year. I didn't even need, it wasn't financial. I needed to be with my parents. I was in a life change that I needed to be just with my parents. So I think it's really important that we not judge and we not have these absolute rules that different generations can't live together at different stages in life. Conversely, you might have something where you might be living with your parents because they need your help. Maybe you have aging parents and it's not about your financial dependence or money at all. So I love the idea of generational households. I think that that can be a blessing in the right phase.
Yeah. Well, just the idea of having close relationships with your adult children, as this evolves, as adolescence does take longer. I mean, there was a time when, I mean, my parents got married at age 21. So of course they're off launched on their own very young, but that's just not something people really do so much anymore. And so having those extra years where people are building their lives and you can still be a part of it as a parent is kind of a cool concept. So
I think it's a really cool concept. And I think that you could have a whole different discussion with someone who has a different level of expertise, whether these are good trends or not, that people are getting married later and forming households later. But when you look back, was it the best thing that a lot of women were dropping out of college because they got married and then they never had that economic independence so that they would have it later in life when inevitably many women do need it through divorce or being widowed or whatever it may be? And was it so good for a 21-year-old man to suddenly have no time to sort of evolve their career where they suddenly have to be the breadwinner and it's all on them because the women couldn't work? It's a whole separate discussion, but I'm not sure these are bad trends that we're doing these things later and letting people breathe a little bit first.
You went, you know, one question you put, and this is something that I think is not an automatic thought for maybe women that you need to, that it's good to have the thought though, that what does it cost to be me? Mm-hmm. And that I am responsible for that, right?
Yeah.
Because that has not historically been that whatever it costs to be you raising X number of kids is something that you are personally responsible for. And obviously, you know, there are lots of different ways families are structured and we're big fans of stay-at-home parents here at Best of Both Worlds too. But it's good to at least go into it thinking about what resources are going to be necessary and whether you have the option of creating those resources on your own should you need to.
Yeah. And I should say I've had a very hybrid work experience. And I have talked about this. Most of the reason that I left being a full-time journalist was because I did want to be home more with my kids. It's so funny. I look at my first book and I write it, you know, my seven-year-old is sleeping. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I was so young. He was such a baby. He's 16
now. We're all young
now.
Once of the day. Yes.
But, oh gosh. But you know, I just wanted to be home with him. And, you know, that's why I went from being a full-time journalist to being an author so that I could have this hybrid life where I could still have a career, but also it's not always just about getting the and paying for the childcare. It's also about the experience of being a parent. I have a friend who's always reminding me, don't forget, it's the journey. It's the journey. It's not just getting it done. And I think that's so important. And I'm so glad that you brought that up. But I do think that especially after the pandemic, what's really wonderful is a lot of stay-at-home parents, whether they're moms or dads, can have a more of a hybrid approach to work if they choose to. And that's really been a gift for me.
Yeah.
That now I'm talking to you from my home office versus before the pandemic, even when I worked for myself, I went into an office because of just the social pressures and the social norms. And now my 16-year-old is waiting. And when we're done, I'm taking him to his tennis lesson.
Excellent.
And isn't that great? And then when I'm done with that, I'll come back and I'll be writing my weekly newsletter, which tends to be bi-weekly sometimes because I'm not as good as your time management skills. I need to get better at listening to that. Your morning podcast, which I love.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's important. You made a really good point and a very important point for all of us.
Oh, excellent. Well, so we always end with a love of the week. So I can go first. So you can think of it if you would like. But I'm going to throw out the concept of reverse ATMs, which has saved me in a few situations. So the number of places that have gone cashless since the pandemic is kind of startling to me as a person who likes cash and also likes to give children cash because I feel like they can use it. And if they lose it, they haven't lost that much of anything. It's not a problem. But so many places are cashless now. So I've like sent kids to amusement parks on like youth group trips. And they're like, wait, I can't use my cash. I have to use a card. But most of these places now have installed machines where they're reverse ATMs. You put in the cash, get out a card for that amount. And so then you can use that. So I think that's kind of a cool technology as well.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's really smart. And it really is a way of bridging the gap between the sort of push and pull between, because people always ask me, they frame digital money as such a problem, but it's the reality. So it's important that we can sort of go between both worlds. So,
yeah.
There, I made a pun on your podcast.
Exactly. All right. What's your love of the week, Bobby?
So my son just came back. I have a 16-year-old who goes to boarding school. He's in 10th grade. And he just came home for spring break a couple of days ago. And what's interesting is, with teenagers, this could happen, I'm sure, if your kid's home full-time as well. But it seems like they're changing, all kids are changing constantly. But you get it in chunks when they come home from boarding school. And so he just came home and I haven't seen him in person. Well, I saw him in person in New York a month ago, but still. Having these full conversations with him, he's like this mini adult. He changes and he's suddenly challenging me on things. And his new thing, and this is a fun, interesting thing that people can try with their teenagers. His new phase is he is listening to these songs, rock and roll songs, kind of. I don't know. He was listening to Guns N' Roses and also Hotel California. I think that's the Eagles. I don't know. I don't even know these songs, but I kind of know them, but I don't know who sings all of them. And he's looking at the words and sort of trying to figure out, well, what is the true meaning of this song? And apparently, for example, he told me, and people can look this up, I haven't verified this yet, Hotel California is actually about materialism and the quest for more and more success in America.
You can check out, but you can never leave, I guess.
I had no, right. We're constantly striving for more. That's what he said. But the point is, I'm having these deep conversations with this man child, this teenager who's 16, that I've never had before. He suddenly became this super intellectual, curious kid who's just like researching all these songs. He's researching David Bowie songs. And I don't want to say what some of those are about, but I was like, oh, okay. You know, he's challenging me. It's just so interesting when your kid changes on you in a fascinating way that you didn't see coming. So that's my love.
Well, and I bet he's like 2 inches taller than the last time you saw him as well. So that's always...
Yeah, that happens too. Yes. And the irony is, and we went to the pediatrician, which he was sort of, he felt humiliated. I don't know if teenage parents can understand this, because they do have to still go to a pediatrician at age 16.
They do.
And he wasn't happy about that because you've got these like toddlers in the office. Because it's spring break. So the kids down here are in school. So there's no other teenager at 10 a.m. on a Monday in the pediatrician's office. But he's there with the babies that aren't in school yet.
Yeah.
But the pediatrician clarified that they do take kids certainly till 18 and sometimes 21. So anyway.
Pediatric and adolescent health, yes. All right, so Bobby, anyway, let everyone know where they can find you.
You can find me at financialwellnessstrategies.com, where you can learn more about that business. You can also buy my book, Launching Financial Grownups, on Amazon, or ideally, I'll say at your local bookstore, but if they don't stock it because it's been out for a year, please ask them to get it. And the same thing at libraries. Libraries, if you don't see it at your local library, please ask them to stock it at your local library, because we always do want to support libraries.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Bobby. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we are back. We're listening to Bobby Rebell talk about launching financial grownups and how we can help young adult children and teens and tweens figure out how to navigate the world of money. So this question came to Sarah. I can read it. It says, do I have this right that neither of you use Google Calendar or digital calendars at all? How do you schedule appointments that go on your paper planner when you go out? Do you have a different system for how, and do you write down tasks like call for doctor's appointments and events like Mother's Day brunch? Sarah, are we writing on cave walls? Like, how far in the past are we living?
I know this is kind of funny. As you read the question, I'm like, the question did seem a little incredulous. I'm like, but in 2010, I mean, no one was carrying around a phone. So either you were using like a Palm Pilot or you were whipping out your laptop, and then that would have been weird, right? So like, anyway, yes, I bring my planner with me. I usually have my Hobonichi cousin everywhere I go. It is honestly just not that big. I mean, I look at the purses and backpacks most people carry around, and there usually is enough space for a planner. I usually carry like a kind of average size tote bag. It has my planner, my wallet, sunglasses, keys. That's about it. But that means if I'm at an appointment, I can just turn to the day and write it down right then and there. Now, if I do happen to go somewhere and I don't bring it with me for whatever reason, then I just take my best guess. Like I know that usually Tuesdays and Thursdays are more flexible. And then I tell them I may have to call them and reschedule, and I email it to myself using my phone right then and there. So then I know when I'm clearing my inbox, I'll see that appointment, be able to either write it in my planner if it works out, or if it doesn't, be like, uh-oh, I have to call and fix it. But honestly, that doesn't happen all that often.
Yeah, I often bring my little calendar with me if I'm in a situation where I think I might need to schedule something. And sometimes when I'm traveling, I just take a picture of the next few weeks in the little calendar. It's a pocket-sized, at-a-glance weekly calendar. And this is separate from my planner. So the calendar is where I put time-specific stuff, and that is for the whole year so I can schedule stuff out as far as I need to. I buy the next year's in like September, so then I have that to schedule out for the next year for anything. The planner is where I create my priority lists for an actual week and create my daily to-do list. So I have two separate things. But because of that, the calendar is quite tiny and is no bigger than a phone. So it can go anywhere. If I'm worried about losing it, like I said, I take pictures of the next few weeks and then I have that on my phone so I can consult that if I happen to not have the paper calendar with me. And yeah, I've taken guesses too. If for some reason I don't have it and find I need to make an appointment, I will guess and then call back if I need to. It's really not that challenging. I haven't had anyone really look at me like I am carving on a cave wall. I mean, maybe it could happen, but
I'm okay if
it works, it works. if it works, it works. I mean, really in life, if something works, it works, right? Like this is a blanket productivity tip. You do not have to change just because everyone around you has. Now, I understand that if you're working in a major corporation, you have to use Outlook for your work meetings and things like that. But you can still have your own calendar that's separate. I mean, or you can, you know, if you know roughly what your work hours are, you can have those and then schedule things outside of it on your own paper calendar if you want to. Or you can have one digital calendar that's like Google and you import your stuff from work. And so you can see it there and you can put your own stuff on Google and then nobody needs to know about it at work, but you have one source of truth as well. So lots of different options. Figure out what works for you and then stick with it, right? I think it's the changing that can make people lose stuff. Well, this has been Best of Both Worlds, talking about launching Financial Grownups with Bobby Rebell. We will be back next week with more on making work and life fit together.
Thanks for listening. You can find me, Sarah, at theshoebox.com or at @the_shoebox on Instagram.
And you can find me, Laura, at lauravanderkam.com. This has been the Best of Both Worlds podcast. Please join us next time for more on making work and life work together.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeira. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.